also we were there to do like a computer program because the community actually wanted to learn about computers because the kids all knew about Facebook, even though they had never seen or touched a computer. They knew what Facebook was, and that's what they wanted, right? It's important in our work to kind of not dictate to the community what we think they should want or what we think they should need, but it's more about like, what do you guys want? And we try to kind of help bring that to them, right?
Mm-hmm.
As like as a group coming from the other side of the world. So they wanted to learn about computers, so we went there, and our focus was teaching them computers and this youth thing as well.
So they got Facebook.
We taught them how to. So we like through the money that we fundraised to go there.
Yeah.
We were able to access internet, and they had some computers that were donated from like the federal government of the Philippines. So it all kind of came together, and we were able to run this workshop in the Philippines. maybe you can handle the policy stuff.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that, like, not only is Canada home to like 75% of all the big extractive companies in the world, but like basically the way I see it is, it's important to for us as Canadians to kind of take this responsibility on, because we are living in a world where we have access to things like the internet, which is proving to be like more and more powerful as the years go on, right? And just like, I don't know, just like, I think that it's important for people, it's important to do the work that we do here, because by changing people's mindsets within Canada, that's kind of like what can hopefully eventually shift everything for the better, you know? Like, we all have the opportunity to vote, and just through educating people on what they're actually voting for and what their money is going into and all these kinds of things, then we can attack it from where it's rooted, right, which is in Canada.
So. If I'm not mistaken, they also have a center of mining justice or something with them. The Monk Center, or it's a sub bit or something.
They have peace and conflict studies.
Yeah,
part
so, yeah.
of the Monk Center, you know. It used to be for international studies. Now it's the Monk School of Global Affairs.
It's kind of like a story that you hear often out of like the Central and South American countries or other countries where mining companies come in to exploit, where they form these relationships with governments, and people that used to work for the mining company or used to work for the government actually hold positions in each other's organizations.
Yeah.
This sounds like that kind of story, but it sounds like the kind of story that you'd hear from another country. How proud is Ramona of you now?
I think she's proud.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get the odd message from her on Facebook and stuff. It's tough because like their access in on the island is very minimal. So like there's minimal contact. But I know that she knows that I'm here doing everything that I can, and I constantly remind her that I will be back and I will see her again, and I basically remind her that I am here working and I haven't forgotten about her, and that one day I will come with information that just will help her with her struggle, you know?
Yeah, it sounds like it's...
And contacts as well.
Contacts, right. Of course, yeah. Like, just building everything that I can into one package that I can send to her, and then that she has the tools to kind of excel with what she's doing, because she's limited where she is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because of access to internet and just access to anything, really. They're very remote.
It's kind of a nice human story that something just so terrible still manages to create these nice relationships,
mm-hmm.
and these connections.
People want jobs. That's true. You know, I mean, global unemployment phenomenon thing going on. And I mean, lots of communities, they do have jobs, they're just not counted. For example, agriculture jobs. Often, you know, when you hear these stats that people are living off of less than a dollar a day, I think in lots of those cases, people are in fact living off the land and perhaps making a dollar cash a day, mm-hmm. or something like that. But mining doesn't offer that many jobs. It offers a lot of jobs maybe in the construction project period, but then afterwards, you'll have giant gold mines that only have 250 employees. You know, many will have 1,000 employees. But compared to the size of the project, I mean, you know, you get a grocery store in Toronto that has 700 employees, you know, just to put things a little bit in perspective, right? But, you know, a mine will impact an area almost the size of Toronto, it seems.
And they tend to drive up prices of things in the area as well. So you might get a job, but you might not actually have as much, as any more spending power than you did before the mine arrived.
You know, I mean, I think that people, like, that are employed, the lucky people that do get employed by the mines, you know, they do have a lot of spending power. And you can see that transform communities, because all of a sudden there's a certain class of people that's out at the bars all the time. You know, you see an increase in things like prostitution in mining-impacted communities. You know, but then you also see, like in Fort McMurray, or in other communities, you know, especially around here in Australia and other places, where all of a sudden the rents will go way up. And everything will be more expensive. So you're either one, someone with a mining job, in which case you kind of benefit in this short-term sort of way, but then everyone that's not in the mining industry, just every cost goes up for them.
You see that here in Calgary.
Yeah, exactly.
Tarzan's phenomenon.
Exactly, you know, boomtown.
And actually also economics. Still in Canada, when they talk about, you know, building the pipelines and how many jobs it's going to create. Yeah, you create jobs building the pipeline, but then again, once it's built, it doesn't take a lot of people to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to
say wanted to say something about what you were saying earlier, like with the CSR projects and stuff. It kind of goes back to what I was saying about in the Philippines. Like, when we went there, we kind of assessed the situation first and asked them what they wanted to learn, and then in turn we would give that to them. Whereas these CSR projects, like she said, building the school by the mine, well, like, do they want the school by the mine? Like, who is making the call to say that the mining company, in collaboration with the Canadian Aid and the NGOs on the ground, like, who's dictating what's being built and how these, like, their CSR projects, like, are they relevant to the people? Do the people want these? Or is this us pushing our ideas of what people need? You know?
Mm-hmm. Or simply just creating something to make it look like we're giving them what they need.
Yeah.
With very little consultation, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, I think it was Bill 300, which was put in front of the government to try to put some of these kinds of laws in place in Canada. That was shot down. Maybe, Sakura, you want, or Brendan, if one of you want to talk a bit about that?
Sure, I can take that one. So, Bill 300 was a part of a process. So in 2005, the Canadian government admitted in a Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs and International Trade Committee report that that Canada had no laws to prevent human rights abuses abroad of their companies, right? So it's the lack of legislation, really. And then this spurred on the roundtables process. And the roundtables process was a series of public forums where they would hear from mining-impacted communities, they would hear from civil society advocates. I actually took part in the roundtables and the one that they had in Montreal. And from this roundtables process, they came up with a report of recommendations. And the interesting thing is that these recommendations were actually agreed on by the Prospector and Developers Association of Canada and some mining companies. So it had kind of a consensus process between civil society actors like Mining Watch Canada and the Halifax Initiative and mining companies themselves to just come up with certain standards where, you know, mining companies should meet these certain standards. Now, this was supposed to be acted on by the Harper government to implement some sort of policy, implement an ombudsperson, and instead, the Harper government ignored it for years. They finally respond to the roundtable's process with their own report, and it was called Building the Canadian Advantage, a CSR strategy for the Canadian international extractive industry. Now, that's absurd, right? You know, we were talking about human rights and environmental devastation and economic justice, and all of a sudden he's talking about building Canada's advantage. And it turns out that in that document, he spells out the policy that we see being implemented today. So that's, we're going to give, you know, mining companies more subsidies. You know, the problem, there's definitely a problem with the mining companies, but it's a problem of PR. You know, obviously everyone thinks that the mining companies are really bad, so we should give the mining companies more money so that they can publicize how good they actually are. And this is the process that named, you know, Marketa Evans, the CSR counselor, instead of having an ombudsperson. And so Bill C-300 was a reaction to that. They were saying, okay, if you're not going to make a law, we will. And it was a private member's bill put forward by a liberal candidate, or by a liberal, John McKay. And it basically codified the recommendations of the roundtables process. And it had a bit of a consequence, a penalty for breaking, you know, human rights, for having human rights abuses or breaking environmental norms. And that was that if a company, after an investigation, was found to be abusing human rights or, you know, breaching international norms, the CPP would divest money, the ED, Export Development Canada would divest support, and Canada itself would divest diplomatic support. So it didn't really treat the government of Canada like a government that's capable of shutting down a company or, you know, taking away its corporate status or disallowing it on the Toronto Stock Exchange, for example. It treated mining as an investment of the Canadian government and only spelt out the conditions by which Canada would take away that investment. So many people saw this as a very weak bill. But the fact is that the Canadian government is the number one investor and supporter of Canadian mining, so it actually was a pretty strong bill, and it lost by 6 votes.